Hello, and welcome to Volume 41 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss how forests can do two things that society demands. That is, trap carbon, and the second is to produce fuel. We'll talk to a landowner who's had some problems using the lumber that he cut off his own land. And we'll talk to a number of experts on wildlife, property valuation, and forest management. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. It's often said that trees are a renewable resource. That's a promising thought in today's high energy prices. Our first guest is Philip Badger. He's with a company called Renewable Oil International. It's a renewable resource company located in Florence, Alabama. Hello, Philip.
Hello.
Why don't you begin by telling us what your technology does with these renewable resources like trees?
Okay, we use a process called fast pyrolysis, which we refer as kind of a cousin of direct combustion or wood gasification. In simple terms, it's similar. If you think of burning a log on a fire, it goes through several stages. As you put the log on, it goes through a drying phase, and then as it heats up, it begins to decompose and give off volatiles and so on. And then at some point, all the volatiles are given off, and it just you just have a char left, which glows bright red in the fire as it burns. Basically, if we want to make a bio-oil, what we do is we collect those gases and vapors that are coming off. We're doing this in an oxygen-free environment, and then we run the gases and vapors through a condenser, and by definition, vapors are a liquid in gaseous form, and we condense and get an oil. And we get about 60% by weight yield of the oil, or about 120 gallons a ton. But we also get some char and some gas out of the process, and we use that for the process heat for the process. So it's pretty much a closed loop situation.
Okay, you're converting wood products to oil, char, and gas. Then what efforts could this type of thing, or what is your effort, and how could it affect the forest products industry? Can you use wood, for example, in this product?
Yes. In fact, we can use virtually any type of biomass, and that includes virtually any type of wood, mill and harvesting residues, including bark, small diameter wood, whatever. Another big advantage is that the bio-oil has multiple markets. We can use it for energy, for example, in certain engines or combustion turbines, even boilers, co-firing. There are chemicals that can be extracted. There are other uses. Another big advantage, though, is that there's been some studies done that show up to 70% of the feedstock cost, and I'm calling feedstock, of course, the raw material we're processing, can be in handling, which means just moving it from starting with harvesting through to your end-use point. And that's a very significant part of the cost, and we can significantly impact that because if you compare the bio-oil technology to direct combustion or gasification, those processes must have the conversion on site because they have to be right beside their use, their energy use, which means that you have to haul the raw wood all the way. And to put it in perspective, if you have green whole tree chips, you can get about 100,000 BTUs in a cubic foot. If you have bio oil, you now have about 600,000 BTUs. So we're increasing the amount of energy in a given volume by about a factor of six, which significantly reduces cost. And with that capability, then, we can set up satellite plants out in the field, basically become green oil wells, you might think of it. And we can do this because we have small modular plants that are transportable, keep the cost down because they're factory fabricated, and keeps on-site installation fast.
Well, in any new technology, I guess you're looking at how your conversion process compares with other ways of producing similar products. How do you compare those two?
There's three factors we have to look at. One is, of course, the cost of the feedstock, the conversion cost, and then what you're competing against in the market. The conversion costs are pretty fixed, and it's about $1.50 per million BTU. And that includes all the cost of conversion except for the feedstock. Now, for each $10 a dry ton of wood, you have to add another dollar per million BTU. So, for example, at $10 a dry ton, the cost now is $2.50 per million BTU. To put that in perspective, the natural gas price in Alabama in February this year was $7.36 per million BTUs, which is equivalent to $7.36 per 1,000 cubic foot. So you can see that given the right scenarios, we can certainly compete and have a major impact on using wood, adding value, and helping the rural economy.
Okay. Well, thank you, Philip. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Our next guest is John Godby, who is with a forestry consulting firm known as F&W Forestry. He studied an issue related to something called carbon sequestration. It's a term that's not familiar to many of our listeners. We wanted to ask him about it. Hello, John.
Good morning.
Tell us real briefly, what is carbon sequestration and why should we care?
Over the last few years, there's been increasing concerns about rising levels of atmospheric carbon. Mm-hmm. Primarily, carbon levels are increasing due to the burning of fossil fuels. While there's been a somewhat of a debate as to the consequences, the consensus of everyone is that we do have increased levels of atmospheric carbon. Carbon sequestration is simply a method of using Mother Nature through the process of photosynthesis to remove excess carbon from the atmosphere and fix it in solid products through growing trees or other vegetation.
Okay. So it's removing it from the atmosphere and storing it on Earth.
And grain products.
Okay. You're located in Statesboro, Georgia, is that right?
That's correct.
And I understand that Georgia, the state of Georgia, has developed some legislation around this whole carbon sequestration issue. What is it?
Yes, we had a number of clients and other interested parties in our company and through the Georgia Forestry Association express interest in developing market for carbon trading.
Mm-hmm.
And so through the Georgia Forestry Association, we worked with one of our state senators down in Albany, Georgia, Senator Michael Meyer von Bremen, and developed legislation that put some certainty into the trading process. Essentially, this legislation identified and defined carbon, put some tight definitions around the definition of carbon so that the market would understand and recognize the product being traded in a consistent product from one landowner or one source to another.
Okay. Does that help the marketability of it?
It improves the marketability by willing buyer, willing seller, and a certain trade. You understand what you're buying, and the ownership of it is guaranteed.
Okay. Let me ask you, finally, after this legislation, if it has been passed, by the way?
The legislation was passed in this past legislative session and signed into law by Governor Perdue in May of this year.
Okay. What do you see as the future of buying and selling these carbon units or whatever you want to call them?
There is increased interest by manufacturing groups, coal-fired plants, oil and gas plants, others that are emitters of carbon into the atmosphere through a manufacturing or a combustion process to reduce the limits of carbon that the levels of carbon that they are emitting. Control limits right now are getting pretty close to technical maximization or economic maximization, and so they're looking for alternatives. And one alternative has been the trading of carbon from one industry to another or carbon emission rights, and the other has been the ability to increase production by offsetting those that production increase by purchasing and promoting the growth of trees to increase the removal of carbon from the atmosphere.
So a landowner could contract with, in simple terms, a landowner could contract with a manufacturing facility to offset some of the CO2 that the manufacturing facility is by necessity going to have to release?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, thanks, John.
Thank you.
You may be familiar with the fact that the federal government conducts periodic inventories of forest land. This information is collected and is useful for industry to determine where and how much raw material is out there, and it's also useful to sociologists and others who follow trends in forest ownership. The state of Mississippi has recently decided to conduct its own survey, and this project is being headed up by Wayne Tucker, Executive Director of the Mississippi Institute for Forest Inventory. Hello, Wayne.
Good morning.
Wayne, why would Mississippi want to take on this task that is already being accomplished by the U.S. Forest Service?
Well, I can probably start by giving you a little history. In the late 1990s, our Mississippi forest industry, and when I say forest industry, I'm saying everyone that is involved in forestry, landowners, foresters, especially Mississippi State University, and also large and small companies, noticed that we were having a rapid change in the resource in Mississippi. And so a task force was developed to study this, and they wanted to have a comprehensive, coordinated strategy to plan the maximum use for the potential of our state's forest resources.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Forest Service, they do an excellent job on a statewide basis on their forest inventory. But we noticed that when companies, existing companies that were already in Mississippi or companies that were interested in coming to Mississippi, they wanted county information because they would draw their information on whether to locate on a county basis, not a state basis. Very few companies use the entire state for their raw mm-hmm. material. And so this task force said that the best thing that we needed to do as a state was to develop a inventory process so that we could go to the county level.
Okay.
So, and we're going to be doing the county levels at the plus or minus 10% at the 95% confidence level.
How do you anticipate being able to use this information once it's collected?
Well, it's going to be used by existing companies whenever most companies do a 5, 10, and 15-year economic analysis for their business. So they'll be able to use it, but we're also using it on potential customers that may be wanting to relocate to Mississippi, and they'll be able to do their economic analysis and find out if they have enough raw material in the area and to sustain their business.
Okay. All right. Well, that's interesting. Thank you, Wayne.
Appreciate
you joining us.
All righty.
Many forest owners have realized that they can grow trees while at the same time lease the same land for various other activities like livestock production or agriculture. How to value these activities is a question we'd like to pose to our next guest. His name is Dr. Walt Privat. He's with the Department of Agricultural Economics and Rural Sociology at Auburn University. Hello, Walt.
Good morning.
Tell me some things that rural landowners should consider when they're considering leasing land, not so much for hunting, I'm not really talking about that, but just for other types of activities.
Okay, first we're going to just go over some of the most common ones. There's quite a long list of items that really could be considered, but some of the more common ones are, you know, obviously who is going to lease the land.
Mm-hmm.
Is this an individual or a partnership, a corporation or government? And it does make a difference. The different entities are going to have some different uses and different practices that they may use on your land, and so you certainly want to be aware of who that person is that's renting and how they may be wanting to use your land. Someone said once that renting your land to someone is like loaning your money to someone, and obviously there's something to that because each of those has value, and you certainly want to be able to maintain your value and earn something from the assets that you're renting. So obviously, the character of the individual, the reputable reputation, does he pay his bills? Those things are important.
There are a couple of others. You mentioned who is one. A couple of other things that you should consider.
Right. What is being leased is mm-hmm. obviously important. Whether or not this is pasture land or is it crop land, and does along with the crop, renting the crop land, does hunting the hunting rights go with the crop land as well? And the same thing can it be applied if it's timber land is used for you know, for grazing rights for cattle or something to that extent. In addition, how long is this the lease? Is it a, you know, an annual lease or a multi-year lease? And for what use? This is something that oftentimes is not adequately described, and a lot of times there develops some confusion over you know, what exactly is being, you know, considered there.
Okay, so let me ask you then, if one decides to lease for some other purpose in addition to growing trees, how do you go about determining the value of these various options that you've got in front of you?
Okay, there's basically three approaches to determining value. The one that most of us use, of course, is the market approach, where we collect information from other landowners that have leased their land and to get an idea of what rates that they've received, you know, for their properties.
Mm-hmm.
Another approach is to approach it from a cost type of basis, where you have a certain amount of money invested and you'd like to earn a certain return from the use of that asset.
That's a more financial related way of looking at it, right?
That's
what
right.
It costs you and what you want to make. Okay.
That's right. A third approach would be some type of crop share or livestock share arrangement, where the leaser receives a portion of the commodity produced as a payment to, you know, for the land.
Okay.
And all of those have different values of, based on the amenities that are provided with the land, the size of the tract, does it have fencing, well water, pole barns, those kinds of amenities that would add value.
Okay. Well, thanks, Walt, for helping us try to understand how to lease land for other purposes. Appreciate you joining us.
You're welcome.
In some situations, more is not better, and certainly that's the case with pine trees, where overstocking is considered a bad thing. We've asked Dr. David Moorhead, who's a professor of silviculture and deals regularly with thinning and thinning these overstock stands, to join us. Hello, David.
Good morning.
And simply put, how can you tell if you've got too much of a good thing?
Well, quite often when we're dealing with particularly naturally regenerated stands, we often operate on a feast and famine mode, and we either have too few, or in many cases with good conditions, good rainfall, good seed crop, we can have way too many seedlings out there. Numbers are somewhat imprecise, but usually when you're in the range of 1,500 to 5,000 stems per acre and higher, you've got too many seedlings out there to really expect the stand to develop and grow to its potential.
You've probably got a serious problem at that point, don't you?
You definitely do, and in some cases you can get as many as 20,000 seedlings in a really good good regeneration year. So it can be a problem that really will impact the ultimate growth and the value of the stand.
Well, I've often heard that, you know, Mother Nature will correct itself. Is this something that can straighten itself out on its own?
Well, over time, the trees can do pretty good on their own. The problem that you have there is that self-thinning process that will occur will take a long period of time, usually much longer than what a normal rotation would be considered for most individuals. And during that process, overstock stands may not ever develop good wood, good diameter development, good stocking across the site. And in a lot of cases, what will happen is that thinning process involves insects, which will come in and take out the poorer quality trees or those that are suppressed. So quite often you're going to have some pretty high mortality events associated with that thinning process over time. So the landowner really loses any value that he's been trying to accumulate in that investment to get that stand regenerated.
Well, if a landowner wanted to correct the situation by some mechanical means, how is pre-commercial thinning done physically?
There's several ways, and we've got some good crews that are available to do that work. Typically what we're looking at is trying to get the numbers of stems per acre down to probably the 500 to 700 range is generally what we're looking at. So in effect, kind of creating a plantation-type approach for spacing. That can be done with a variety of equipment. Bush hogs, large flail mowers can be used to literally mow down strips of seedlings or trees within the stand. Usually these have cutting widths of up to 8 feet or so, and simply creating rows of strips of trees left after the mowing will really reduce the stocking. Then you can go back in and select individual trees within those leaf strips, which may be a foot or two wide after the initial cutting. Okay. There's also an operation where you can come in with brush saws and, in some cases, machetes to take down individual trees and literally space out each individual tree. And you may want to do that leaving trees on an 8x8 or perhaps even a 10x10 spacing.
Probably have to do that early on, I guess.
It depends. One of the things you can get to it too early when the seedlings are within the first 2 or 3 years of growth. Quite often, if you can't mow them off at the ground and you leave any green needles or limbs below the point where you cut them, they will continue to survive. So usually you're looking at something probably in the 2 to 3 year range as a point to start. We have done pre-commercial thinning in naturally regenerated stands that were 10 to 12 years old, and that required heavier equipment or the use of something like brush saws to go in and remove individual trees.
Okay. Thanks, David. Bill Klingler is a forest owner who's had a disturbing experience with his forest land, and we wanted to share it with you. Hello, Bill.
Good morning.
Bill, where is your land located first?
In Bullitt County, Alabama.
Okay. I understand that you had been planning on building a structure on your property using actually the lumber that you harvested from your own land. What were you thinking about the advantages of doing that sort of thing?
Well, I just thought that you would, you know, save a little money there and be able to utilize your own product.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what I had actually done was hire a commercial barn builder. And I had asked him the feasibility of me selling lumber to them to use in their barn construction and other places. And that's what the thing was. I never did really get into it. I was just sort of, you know, seeing what the feasibility of doing this would be as far as a business endeavor would be.
Okay, so you were actually harvesting and then manufacturing the lumber there. Did you want to use it yourself to build a barn?
No, actually I wanted to, you know, just retail the lumber to other people is what I was interested in.
I see. Okay.
I asked this barn builder, you know, if he would be interested in using my lumber, and he said he only used certified lumber.
What did that mean to you? What would certified lumber be, and how did that affect your ability to market your own lumber?
Well, it just really took me back, you know. I had no idea. I'd never heard of this, but I could understand his viewpoint a little bit, I guess. He says that if he builds a structure, he wants certified lumber, and the only reason I could see for him wanting this is so if he had a problem with the actual structure, he thought he had something to fall back on with certified lumber. And I don't really understand that, and I just don't understand how that works.
Did that prevent you from being able to market your lumber to this particular?
Well, I actually hadn't produced the timber, but I haven't gone as far as setting up a mill or anything like
mm-hmm.
this. This was just all in the thinking process,
mm-hmm.
and I was sort of seeing, you know, what the feasibility was, and this question I asked him changed my whole viewpoint. You know?
After having your experience, what suggestions would you have to others who are trying to do the same thing you're doing?
Well, the landowners, you know, need to get together a little bit and sort of try to solve these problems that I didn't even know we had. I wasn't aware that you couldn't sell your own timber freely, you know, from your own property, from your own mill, and then you get ready to sell it, and they tell you it needs to be certified.
Mm-hmm.
So it just sort of threw me back a little bit. I didn't know. I just wasn't aware of this problem at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Bill, thanks for bringing that to our attention.
Thanks for having me.
Our next guest is Dr. Ralph Murarkey, who is the William and Fay Ireland Professor of Wildlife Sciences at the Auburn University School of Forestry and Wildlife Sciences. Welcome, Dr. Murarkey.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've written a set of books that we wanted to highlight. I think they're called the Alabama Wildlife Series. Can you just tell us a little bit? I think there's four of them. Can you tell us a little bit about what is contained in each of these four volumes that comprise this series?
Yes, I'd be glad to. Volume 1 contains an annotated list of every known wildlife species in the state that has a backbone, and it also has a selected list of aquatic mus- beetles and snails. Each annotation in the list provides the common name, scientific name of the animal, the relative abundance statement, whether it's rare or common, something like that. General description of distribution of the state, description of habitats where it's found, and its state priority designation from highest conservation concern to lowest conservation concern, which is analogous to the highest conservation concern would be an endangered or imperiled animal. Also numerous color photographs. So that's a checklist of all, basically all the vertebrate and selected invertebrates of the state in Volume 1. In Volume 2, that contains an in-depth treatment of the imperiled species, those that are highest and high conservation concerned. And these are the aquatic mollusks and snails, and it includes a color photo and distribution, color distribution maps of each, physical description, distribution and habitats in the state, basic life history and ecology, and the reason that the species is imperiled. Volume 3 contains the same in-depth treatment as Volume 2, but it covers the imperiled amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. And Volume 4 contains the conservation and management recommendations for all the imperiled species. In other words, what we need to do to ensure that the imperiled species will not be driven to extinction.
Okay. Now, if for Alabama landowners, what value would these particular books have?
Well, from a general standpoint, the books will impact all Alabamians because they will form the basis for the Alabama Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries, wildlife conservation strategy in the state over the next decade or so. More specifically, landowners can use Volume 1, for instance, as a checklist of animals that may be on their property, or they can check with in volumes 2 or 3 to see if there are any potential for endangered or threatened species to be present on their property as well.
What about the program that you mentioned? That is this something new that's coming to Alabama to assess
the conservation strategy as part of a new federal program that is trying to pump more money into conservation activities at the state level. Each state has to draw up a wildlife conservation strategy over the next that will plan, help them plan for what to do with wildlife species for the next decade or so. And these books are going to form the basis of Alabama's strategy in the future.
Okay. For each of these books, can you pick one that you think, or one or two that you think might be of particular interest to a typical Alabama landowner?
If you're interested, for instance, in managing your land, for example, doing prescribed burning or cutting timber in such a way that an imperiled species may be helped or damage to their habitat would be minimized, you might want to purchase Volume 4 for sure, because it gives you all the conservation recommendations and management techniques and these types of things. If you're just interested in seeing what species are likely to be found in the state, you can get away with just the checklist, which is Volume 1. Or if you have an interest in imperiled aquatic species, Volume 2, terrestrial species, Volume 3, etc. Of course, the best deal, both knowledge-wise and financially, is to buy the whole set together because you get a discounted rate on the whole set. What most people don't realize is that all the authors, editors, and publishers have agreed that any royalties above and beyond the cost of printing the books will be deposited in the Alabama Non-Game Wildlife Fund. So wild species, not the authors or editors or publishers, will benefit from purchasing of the books. And so everybody that purchases a book actually helps Alabama wildlife.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Markey. We appreciate you having you.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Our final guest is a forester who has developed a specialty in marketing timberland. He has broad experience as a consultant and can recognize timberland that has value as timberland as well as other uses. His name is Tom Brickman. Hello, Tom.
Good morning, Hayes. How are you?
First, I wanted to ask you whether you felt like timberland is still a good investment even in today's challenging economic times.
Well, we do, because timberland can create value for their owners in a lot of ways that other investments can't.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you look at a share of IBM stock, there's basically two ways that it makes money for you. It can go up in price, and it pays a dividend. Timberland does those things as well as other things. For example, an acre of timberland can go up in value, the price of the land and the price of the timber. But also, if you look at timber, it grows in size. So a 6-inch tree can become an 8-inch tree.
There's biological growth.
And then in addition to that, which stocks don't offer, an 8-inch tree, let's say a pine tree was worth $5 a ton, can grow to a 10-inch tree that's now worth $25 a ton because it's used for something else. It can now be used to make lumber instead of paper.
And none of that happens with the share of IBM stock. It doesn't multiply while it's sitting in your vault.
It does not multiply. Professional investors like pension funds also recognize other benefits from owning timberland. So, for example, they see that if you look back historically, timber and land have been a good hedge on inflation. So when inflation is high, it's good to have money in hard assets like land because they tend not to be affected as much. And in addition to that, professional investors see land as a good stabilizer for large portfolios.
Okay.
It tends not to go up a lot in value, but it doesn't go down a lot in value, and it's countercyclical.
Has some ballast, I guess, to it.
Has some ballast, like a flywheel.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let me ask you what pointers you would give to people who are interested in locating good land buys.
There's two important things that people looking to buy land should keep in mind. Number one is you need to know the value of what it is you want to buy. If you want to buy a pair of shoes, you're going to look around. You're going to go to Walmart, and you're going to go to different stores, and you're going to shop. And so by doing that, you know a good buy when you see it. Land's the same way, but because land's a little harder to find out in the marketplace, people tend not to shop as much. And there's ways around that. There are people that know how to do that and can help you.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is you've got to look locally. The good buys don't jump out. You can look in the paper, and you're going to see some there for sale, but a lot of the good buys are often for sale by owner, and so they don't really get beyond the local coffee shop in terms of advertising. Or perhaps they're handled by local agents, but they don't usually tend to advertise very far from home. And so either you have to have the ability to look locally or work with a company who has local ears and eyes to help you look.
Okay. Finally, if you're either buying or selling, how can you be confident about these, the value that you place on your property?
There's two basic ways that a landowner can be sure. One is whether you're buying or selling is, as we stated earlier, know the value mm-hmm. Whether you're buying or selling. Know ahead of time. Don't ask a buyer or a seller to value your property. If you're a person selling your property and you don't know what it's worth, then you're going to the market and asking a buyer
mm-hmm.
who wants to buy it cheap to tell you what it's worth.
Right.
Know ahead of time, and there's two ways. You can get an appraisal, a formal appraisal done
right.
for $1,000 or $2,000. Another way is to work with a good broker who, as part of his service, will offer appraisal techniques, looking at the comparable sales and offering value by helping you know ahead of time what something's worth.
Okay, that can give us some confidence. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate you joining us.
You bet.
That's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Philip Badger, John Godsby, Wayne Tucker, Walt Brevatt. Thanks also to David Moorhead, Bill Klingler, Ralph Murarkey, and Tom Brickman. A recent newspaper article contained the following headline: Some forest owners will qualify for seedling plantations. Well, if you were curious if you were one of those forest landowners mentioned in the headline, you could read further down the article and find out. The article continues, "The CRP is a continuous sign-up on wetlands administered by the FSA. The EQUIP program conducted by the FSA and the NRCS is for natural resource concerns on agricultural land. The WRP program to restore and protect wetlands on private property and the WHIP program for developing wildlife habitat is administered by the NRCS and the FSA. The AACDCP program provides assistance for practices aimed at erosion control and improving forest resources. The ASWCC committee sponsors that program." Confused? You're probably not the only one. One gets the impression from the article that forestry is dependent on the generous provision of Uncle Sam, not the product of deliberate choices by independent-minded men and women. What are cost-share programs doing to us? Do we want to go there? Are our forestry decisions being shaped with care and attention to the unintended consequences that follow from what appears to be a helping hand? These are questions that we'd like to ponder. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.